We'll go on a record and come to order. The commission is hereby convened in open session on Wednesday, February 25th, 2026, to consider the matter entitled Secretary of Labor versus W.G. Yates and Sons Construction Company, docket number SE-2023-0094. And present are me, Chair Rakovich, Commissioner Jordan, Commissioner Baker, and Commissioner Marvin by Zoom. We'll start with an overview of the case presented by Rory Smith. Rory, take it away.
Good morning. This case concerns a fire which occurred at the Lee Creek Phosphate Mine, located in Aurora, North Carolina, and operated by PCS Phosphate and Nutrient. Nutrient contracted with W.G. Yates and Sons Construction Company to perform repairs at the mine's washer building. The mine's washer building is a facility where raw phosphate ore is washed and screened. It was not in operation at the time the fire occurred. During the repairs, a fire occurred inside of a discharge pipe. The Secretary of Labor's Mine Safety and Health Administration issued Yates a citation after the fire occurred. Yates contested the citation. Prior to starting work, Nutrient had issued Yates a hot work permit, which stated that there were no combustible hazards within a 35-foot radius of the work area. Yates covered the rubber conveyor belts with fire blankets and used an additional blanket in the immediate area of the cuts. The fire occurred when a contractor was using a torch to cut the weld of a steel leg of a screen attached to a beam on the third floor. A heated steel shaving fell into the pan down the drain and then through about 10 feet of discharge pipe, igniting the rubber lining of the pipe's elbow joint. Smoke rose out of the drain and through the corrugated metal floors. Miners discharged a total of 6 fire extinguishers. However, the spray could not reach the burning rubber in the elbow joint. Production operators, emergency rescue teams, fire truck arrived, and miners sprayed water into the pipe. Approximately 17 minutes after the fire started, it was out. During this time, an MSHA inspector happened to be at the mine investigating a separate accident. He observed smoke billowing into the air from about 3 miles away. The inspector then traveled to the washer building, meeting up with Nutrient's acting safety director. After an investigation, the inspector issued Yates a citation alleging a violation of Section 56.4500, which states that heat sources capable of producing combustion shall be separated from combustible materials if a fire hazard could be created. The term combustible material is defined at Section 56.2 as a material that, in the form which it is used and under the conditions anticipated, will ignite, burn, support combustion, or release flammable vapors when subject to fire or heat. Wood, paper, rubber, and plastics are examples of combustible materials. After a hearing, the judge found a violation, concluding that here the heat source was clearly not insulated or removed sufficient distance from the combustible material. The judge also affirmed the citation's S&S designation, relying upon evidence that miners could have inhaled smoke and toxic fumes, and that the miners' exposure to additional hazards, including possible burns and trip and fall hazards. Yates seeks the commission's review of, one, the judge's interpretation of the secretary's regulation, and two, the judge's decision to affirm the citation's S&S designation.
Any questions for Rory?
No, no.
I believe Commissioner Jordan has volunteered to speak first.
Thank you, Chair Rakovich. To me, the question of whether there was a violation correctly cited here, I would affirm the judge's decision in that regard to uphold the citation. I think that the straightforward application of both the regulation at issue, which says that heat sources capable of producing combustion shall be separated from combustible materials. That did not occur in this case. They were allowed to come together. The hot slag from the welding came into contact with the drainage pipe, specifically the rubber lining in the drainage pipe, and rubber is specifically cited as a potential combustible source. The operator, you know, points to a lot of factors at involved here, which I understand, and they go in my mind more to maybe there was not that great of a fault involved in this particular operator, that, you know, it was not something that was very obvious or one that they could be expected to anticipate easily, that the hot slag would go down the drainage pipe and actually ignite, that the drainage pipe had rubber lining that could be ignited. But to me, you know, I have to rely on Section 110 of the statute, that, you know, the straightforward language of 110A1 states the operator of a coal or other mine in which a violation occurs of a mandatory health or safety standard or who violates any of the provision of this act shall be assessed a civil penalty by the secretary, etc. The wording of it, the way it's phrased, you know, in the passive, a violation occurs at a mine. So to me, there's two questions. Did a violation occur? And is the party cited here an operator? And I would answer both those questions, yes. And I think that it would be appropriate to consider the issues raised by the operator in terms of penalty assessed, you know, perhaps there was not a great deal of negligence here. But I believe the judge did take that into consideration, and I think he changed the negligence designation. MSHA had initially cited it as, I forget anyway, I think he lowered it to a moderate level, and he lowered the penalty. So, you know, for that reason, I would be affirming the judge on those points. On the question of whether the violation was S&S, I have to admit, it's hard for me to almost conceptualize a violation of this particular standard, which says, do not let these two ingredients come together because, you know, they'll create a fire. And if there's a violation of that, i.e. that they've come together and there's a fire, I feel that pretty much, you know, a fire at a place is going to be S&S. It's going to have a likelihood of causing harm. There could be injury. And I think here, all right, there were some conflicting factors, you know, argued back and forth. You know, the operator was arguing, well, the ventilation at here involved here was sort of unique in that it went straight up, you know, and out the roof, and people were not really exposed that much to it. On the other hand, you know, it was a lot of smoke. I mean, the inspector was three miles away, you know, or something, when he wasn't planning to visit this facility, but he happened to see billowing dark black smoke coming out. The fire extinguishers didn't work to put it out because it was in a, you know, kind of a unique location, this fire, that made it difficult to extinguish it with the fire extinguishers. In fact, I think they had a call. I think the fire department wound up coming, right? To extinguish it. The operator says, you know, oh, this was fire was contained very quickly. It wouldn't even amount to having to report it under MSHA's regs, which require you to report it, you know, if it's more than 30 minutes to extinguish. And they say, you know, it just took 17 minutes. But, you know, the inspector did offer testimony to the judge. I don't think I can say that the judge, his finding of S&S was not supported by substantial evidence here. Rubber, there could be, you know, a toxic aspect to burning rubber. There was testimony about, you know, the smoke, if it hindered vision, the floor involved that the miners would have to cross to exit had openings, and that could pose a danger. So in my mind, you know, looking at all the factors, I would affirm the judge's finding on the S&S as well. So that's, you know, my tentative positions, and I'll hear from my colleagues. You know.
Okay. Thank you, Commissioner. Commissioner Baker.
Thank you, Chair, and thanks to OGC and Rory for the memo, which was really helpful. So I'm generally in agreement with Commissioner Jordan. You know, I can sort of go through what I have here. It's not going to sound a whole lot different from what she said, but I wrote it, so I'm going to go through it anyway.
We're here. We're not going anywhere. Go ahead.
So the relevant facts are that that WGA performed construction work at the washer at a washer facility, in particular using a torch to cut the welding on a steel screen. During the cut, a hot steel shaving fell down a drain and started a fire. The fire caused black smoke to rise out of the drain. The workers were unable to put out the fire with 6 fire extinguishers. The water had been turned off at the facility, and eventually the rescue team had to show up to put out the fire. One thing, I don't know that it's really relevant here, but it seems strange that you'd be doing something with, you know, torches that are capable of melting steel and you've turned the water off at the facility. I can't imagine what reason there would be for that, but that's sort of beyond our the scope of what we're doing here. So I think that substantial evidence clearly supports the ALJ's decision. So in terms of the violation itself, a heat source capable of producing combustion was not separated from compressible materials, and a fire was created. The hazard expressly countenanced by Section 56.4500 was created in this situation. Therefore, there was a violation of the Act. Further, this violation was S&S. Several hazards were created by this condition, including the fire itself, as well as the thick black smoke that was created by the fire, which burned uncontrolled for at least 17 minutes. Miners were exposed to that hazard. So I think that's really significant, too. I mean, the exposure is an important part of this. There were people right there exposed to this condition. They were near the site of the smoke and inside the building that caught fire. Therefore, I think that this was S&S. So the operator had a couple of arguments as to why this shouldn't have been a violation or should not have been S&S, and I'll sort of go through those. The operator argues that the definition of combustible material requires that the operator be able to anticipate the presence of rubber. I see, you know, the standard says, the secondary standard here, 56.2, says combustible material means material that in the form in which it is used and under the conditions anticipated will ignite, burn, support combustion, or release flammable vapors when subject to heat or fire. But I don't believe that anticipate there is a reasonable construction of what the standard means in context. I mean, as a general matter, and we can cite 1,000, you know, cases for this proposition, the Mine Act is a strict liability statute. When the operator knew or should have known about whether an operator knew or should have known about the underlying condition really goes to the level of negligence, which is not, I don't believe, before us here. Rather than the issue of liability itself. I think I read the term under the conditions anticipated in Section 56.2 not to refer to the operator's knowledge, which would be inconsistent with general Mine Act principles, but instead the nature of the task at hand. So, you know, when you're the task at hand is cutting steel with a welder, obviously that can ignite rubber. It happened here. So that condition is anticipated. If the task had been spraying the rubber with water, maybe they would not have thought of the rubber as combustible material. I don't know. And, you know, if other conditions had intervened that had caused it, but I mean, if somehow bizarrely spraying it with water had accidentally created a fire, maybe that would have been that situation. But the task at hand was applying heat to this condition, and obviously it could catch fire because it did. The operator argues that this would lead to an absurd result because it would have to engage in wide-ranging and complicated searches to determine if rubber or other combustible material was present. I think they just need to assume that that combustible material could be present and take the proper precautions. I mean, they did this, that with the rubber conveyor belts in the area by covering them with fire blankets. If they're, you know, they know that PVC pipe and rubber piping is used, cover up the drain pipes with fire blankets. The operator also challenged the SNS designation. It argues first that fire was not likely to occur and instead was anomalous. Whether or not that is true, I think it is irrelevant. The violation here created a hazard. Miners were actually exposed to that hazard. The ALJ's determination, therefore, is supported by substantial evidence. The operator also claims there's a discrepancy between the possible injuries found by the ALJ and the actual injuries suffered by the miners at the mine. But a finding of SNS does not require a finding that injuries actually occur. Miners were exposed to several serious hazards, including smoke inhalation, fall hazards, and fire hazards. That no one was seriously hurt or injured here is a great thing, but it's not really relevant to that analysis. So in light of those determinations, I would uphold the judge.
Okay, thanks, Commissioner. Commissioner Marvin.
Thank you. And thank you, Rory and OGC, for the memo. I thought it was excellent. I agree with Commissioners Jordan and Baker in their interpretation. So there's not a lot I could add, because most of what I would say would be repeating kind of the facts they've laid out and the reasoning for it. I think the only thing I might add is that my read of Part 56.2 about, you know, I was reading the operator's argument about conditions anticipated, and I agree with Commissioner Baker that I think that they've misread this regulation, but I would even add that that second sentence of the regulation where it says wood, paper, rubber, and plastics are examples of combustible materials, to me reads as those are always considered combustible materials. They come out and say it. I don't think, you know, that first sentence really applies to those. I mean, I don't think there's a situation in which wood is not a combustible material that has to be separated from a heat source, you know, according to Part 56.4500. So, but I mean, I think in either reading, whether, you know, one looks at the conditions anticipated, I think that, you know, clearly the rubber here was a combustible material. It wasn't separated as required. And, you know, I understand they didn't know that the rubber was in the pipe, but I think, as my colleagues have said, that goes to negligence and not to the fact of violation. And then with SNS, I think this is a clear case where it's SNS. You know, the violation, I mean, it contributed to the hazard, and the miners were exposed to that hazard. It was, you know, the hazard of, you know, black smoke, toxic smoke, you know, falling. Like, it's clearly SNS in my view. So, you know, I think this isn't a particularly difficult case in that regard.
All right, thank you, Commissioner. Again, a very fine memo, Rory. Thanks very much.
And yeah, I forgot to thank
you
for the memo, too. I'll just interject that.
Yeah, here. It's very thorough, very thorough.
Yeah.
Let me just hit to the conclusion on mine first, but I'm lone wolf here. I remand this one, and I'll tell you the reason why. I mean, we've talked about how the fire started. All right, you had a slag hit, fell 10 to 15 feet, all right, down through this discharge pipe and contacted this rubber. The secretary cited Yates for violation 56.4500, and it says that heat sources, as we've said before, capable of producing combustion be separated from combustible materials if a fire hazard could be created. Now, as an initial matter, I do agree with the judge that rubber is combustible. As for everything that we've talked here today, it's defined as a combustible, and in the, it doesn't say anything about the a different form or anything like that. It said it will ignite under these conditions. So that, I think, is plain. Again, there's nothing to suggest here that this was a non-flammable type of combustion, non-combustible rubber. It is, in fact, combustible. and it did in fact combust, okay? Yates focuses on the fact that it didn't know that the rubber was there. In other words, it didn't anticipate the conditions. Now, to me, that's irrelevant. I mean, the material it'll either combust or it won't, regardless of whether you know it or not. So that to me, I sort of wave off to the side. Now, the anticipated conditions, I'd interpret that something like under normal operating conditions, sort of an objective assessment of what the conditions are and under which that material would be expected to exist rather than what the operator thinks it would, okay? This did occur in the washing plant, and as Commissioner Baker pointed, normally there'd be water flowing through this pipe.
Right.
Yeah. I understand when they're working on it, there wouldn't be water flowing through that pipe. Now, whether it was cut off at the plant or something, I'm like you, I don't know, all right, is why that would have been. So they're undergoing structural work here, and so under these conditions, there wasn't any water, all right? With a water condition, you probably got a different situation to make, all right, with the slag going down that pipe. So you got a heat source and combustible material. But to me, that's not enough for a violation. Now, the regulation mandates that you got to keep them separated, and I think that's the key here. Now, what does that mean? Now, it doesn't mean not touching. It doesn't mean in not direct contact. That wouldn't serve the purpose of this regulation. When you look at the preamble of that rule, it said separated means either insulated or removed a sufficient distance so that it no longer constitutes an ignition source. You know, so what we're dealing with, yeah, the slag hit it, all right? No question about that. How far away was it? Did they have this source? In other words, what is that sufficient distance? And I think that's the key here, is how do we determine, you know, what is a sufficient distance to keep these things separated? Now, Yates argued, and he used 15 feet. I mean, Rory mentioned 10, whatever it is, 10, 15, whatever it is. They said that's sufficient, okay, when they started out with this thing. The way I read that, Yates is essentially arguing for a reasonable, prudent person test. In other words, would it have been safe to assume that those materials were adequately separated? Judge, on the other hand, found that they were not reasonably separated because the rubber caught fire, which is what we've been talking about here. And to me, that's essentially a per se approach that the judge is taking. So I'm seeing these two different approaches here. Operator is more or less a reasonable person approach. The judge is more or less a per se approach. Now, the reasonable prudent standard, I think that's the one that should have been used here, quite frankly. I don't see a per se approach in this situation. And I think that's what I see as the difference here. I would reverse and remand the judge to develop that record. And again, I'll tell you the reason why. I don't think we have enough right now, if we're going down this path, for us to really make that decision. Under a reasonably prudent person test, it asks whether that reasonably prudent person, familiar with these circumstances at the mine and within the mining industry, would recognize a hazard constituting correction. That's the way I see that particular thing should be applied. And it applies to broadly worded standards. The standard here applies to any combination. The situation here is any combination of ignition sources and combustible materials. All right, apply that would be adaptable. So I think that's the standard that it really applies here. As a practical matter, it clearly requires the operator to make a judgment call as to whether those two items are hazardously close together before they start anything. Now, we know objectively they were too close because the fire occurred. I will give you that, all right? But I don't think that's always going to be the case here, and that's where I'm coming from, is if there is no resultant fire, let's take a look at it that way. Now, the operator, and then obviously an inspector who would be trying to cite something, they're going to have to preemptively decide now is whether that material could, first of all, could the material catch fire, all right? There's no statutory definition of the minimum distance, and there's no math equation to say here you know, if I've got a fire source to this combustible source, at what distance is it that makes it a hazard or makes it combustible? I mean, it would be combustible, but makes it ignitable, let's say. So they got to make that decision just on their just reasonable basis is from the information that they have. I go back to the preamble. It recognizes that the operators have some leeway. Because that's the way it's set. They have to choose to separate. And I think that's the key here when it says separate. They got to choose here, and they can do that either presumptively now by insulation, that would be a separation, or by the distance. So when they come into this situation, they got to make that determination. Now, if we apply this standard here, all right, it logically then would help us to evaluate, did that operator make the right judgment call in this situation in light of the circumstances here? Now, the reason why I don't like the per se approach, okay, I think it's circular. All right, if the way what the judges is saying is, and we go in a circle, if the violation, it's a violation if it can catch fire. And if it catch fire, it's a violation. So I think we're if we go down that path, we're sort of in an endless loop here to try to figure out what to do. I'm not sure how this gets applied, all right, practically. It's not something, I don't know how you can do that on a per se basis, all right? It's not something that you can objectively measure or check before that fire, before the danger arises. Like you can, let's see, we've had cases with air quality and gas levels. All right. So this situation, if you use that approach, you know, do the inspectors have to just wait until a fire happens to know if they violated a standard? The way I see it, if we use a reasonably prudent person test here, the only way to effectively and safely enforce this standard is if we use that standard to see exactly what they did. I think that's the appropriate framework here. So I think we'd have to reverse and remand to allow the parties to develop that record, because neither the parties nor the judge put much emphasis on the industry standards. In other words, what is reasonable in this situation? What is a reasonable distance in this situation? Now, some questions to me, all right? Was it reasonable for Yates to rely on this safe work permit? I don't know that yet. Is my whole point here. Was it reasonable for them to assume under these situations that there was rubber in this discharge pipe? Folks, I can tell you from my experience, I wouldn't have guessed it. I mean, because what that is you got a straight discharge pipe here, all right? I'm guessing, again, I don't know the record, see? That rubber was in that elbow. When this water slurry comes down that pipe and it hits that elbow and takes off in a different direction, it helps to where you don't wear down the pipe, is what I'm thinking. Now, would I know that there's rubber down there? That's the question. I don't know whether a reasonable operator would know that in a situation. You know, if they've dealt with it. All discharge pipes, normally if you got a piping system, you just got a piping system. I have to think that rubber was there for the impact purpose, for slurry, but I don't know that. That's my whole purpose here. I don't know that. And then again, would it be reasonable to think that this weld slag would have dripped enough down 15 feet of pipe without solidifying, let's say, okay, because you've got molten metal. Is it gonna make it to this elbow? I don't know that. In other words, would a reasonable person really do that? That's the questions I think are out there. Now, frankly, I wouldn't get into an S&S analysis in this decision because I don't know enough yet. I think that we'd apply a different, there's a situation where you apply a different test for the fact of the violation, though. If that could lead the judge to make different findings, that would affect the S&S analysis. So my point is, I'd give the judge a chance to take another look at his reasoning here and reevaluate it. Now, you all know how I feel about the consult approach. Let me just touch on that briefly and just go, all right? And if they decide, if a majority decides that should apply here, this is the type of case here where I do believe you could reach different conclusions, about whatever analysis that you put on here, depending upon which S&S analysis that you use. And I think, and I don't know the answer yet. That's the reason why I say I would kick it back to the judge to find out what these things. It could very well be an S&S, but I don't know. I think there are a lot of factors here. So rather than affirming or reversing, I'd remand that whole situation back to him. Now, that said, let me get on this, the topic briefly here. We're looking at what the judge said on the sufficiency of the record. I'm not sure the record actually substantially supports the judge's findings that the fire was likely to result in smoke inhalation. And I'll tell you why. Yates argued that the smoke inhalation impaired visibility, all right? He said it was unlikely because the smoke would have gone up that discharge pipe through a grated roof and to the outside like a chimney without accumulating in the building. Now, that's what Yates is arguing. In rejecting that argument, the judge relied on generalities, though. If you look at what he said, instead of what the actual facts were in that record, he said that under normal mining conditions could include different ventilation patterns causing that smoke to drift. And he cited commission precedent that the risk of smoke inhalation is a common sense conclusion for a fire. Now, I give you that. He's got a case there with an underground, all right? When you got a confined space and underground, I will hand that to you. It makes sense that you definitely have a smoke inhalation problem there. But this is a prep building. It's a surface building. The secretary acknowledged that the smoke rose up through the grates, all right? I don't know what the ventilation pattern is in this smoke, in this building. Now, we do know, as Mary Lou pointed out, this guy could see this thing, a lot of smoke. He could see it 3 miles away. Now, is there, in other words, there's a likelihood that you could have had it, but I don't know what the pattern was in these buildings here. Could that have, in other words, if people are standing around it, was it truly going straight up and no hazard? Was it, you know, did it pair up to the top? I don't know. Where were these people at the time? Even if we assume that they're standing right there around the pipe. And again, these are all questions. And when I was going through this case, I'm thinking, I don't have the answers. You know, I don't have enough here to really say what it is. So anyway, I think that that the whole issue of whether it was a smoke hazard is up in the air, no pun intended, all right? But I don't have enough now to really figure out how that was. So here's the thing. I would kick it back. And on remand, if the judge were to find a violation and if the judge were to reexamine smoke inhalation, now again, I'm going to the injury part, all right? I would think that there would be more clarity brought out as to what was happening inside that building. And I'll even take it back to a console analysis too on a hazard. I think it's still up in the air. Was it actually a hazard if there was no smoke inhalation problem there? Was it really a hazard? Okay? I'll give you, a fire started. Okay? It hit the pipe and a fire started. Now, just as a final note, you know, Yates emphasizes the fact that nothing like this ever happened before. Well, you know, luck isn't a defense to this thing. So I kind of dismissed that. So again, I'll shut up here. I don't think we've got enough. I would reverse and remand on the fact of the violation, and I would say reanalysis under a reasonably prudent person test, and then I would reevaluate everything from that point. So that's my two cents, folks. Yes.
You know, the reasonably prudent person test, again, sometimes my preparation for this case, my mind would be going along some of the pathways, you know, that you were thinking of, what a reasonably prudent person. But that is basically the negligence standard. Here, we have a regulation, and I think of an analogy, for instance, we have a standard that they simply require a certain result. Like, you know, the roof control standard in the mine is what I think of there, where sometimes a similar situation happens, where the requirement is, you know, that the operator, it says the roof and ribs of all active underground roadways, travelways, and working ways shall be supported or otherwise controlled adequately to protect persons from falls of roof or ribs. Now, and then the question arises typically, you know, for an operator, well, what does that mean? What do I have to do? Adequately supported to protect from falls. And there, I think you can sometimes, you know, get into a situation of, well, what would a reasonable person, you know, they should go back and forth, you know, over a mine plan or something. But when you have the roof has fallen, I just feel like, I don't know, there's that phrase, you know, res loquitur, that in the law, where it's like, you, well, whatever you tried to do, it just wasn't adequate to protect against falls because it fell. And it sometimes can come to light. There wasn't really anything noticeable that was really, you know, that giving them an alert of something was inadequate. You know, it fell. And then, so that's, you did not comply with the requirement to support it adequately. Now, there are some times where, let's say it hadn't fallen, or in this case, if a fire had not occurred, that then maybe you get into, there are, you know, the commission has held that where there's very broad standards, and you're kind of figuring out, well, how do I comply with this standard? You do resort sometimes to what would a reasonable operator standard do? Like, you know, maintain your brakes to be safe, you know, support the roof, things like that. And maybe if the inspector had showed up and there was not a fire and there was an argument going on about, well, shouldn't you have the blanket over here? And they were like, no, we think 15 feet is reasonable enough, you know, whatever. I mean, you know, you maybe could have the kind of debate of what would a reasonable operator do. But I think, and I know, and this goes to the strict liability, there's just occasions in the Mine Act where, the, you know, and the law is a certain result is required. That result obviously wasn't met, and there may not be much fault involved, well, but there's a violation.
Here's what I'm saying, though, yeah. Right, on that point right there. What's the standard here? Now, when you're talking about roof control, you say it's on the ground, I give it to you, all right? Your roof control didn't work, okay? There's a violation,
okay.
All right? This, I think, is different. The regulation says, that if you said it said, it shall keep these things separated. And it's not talking about what happens, this, that, and then there shall not be a fire. It says keep them separated. That's what the regulation says.
My point is,
if that's what the regulation says, keep them separated, but it doesn't tell us what that separation is. And there's nothing to actually determine, you know, in other words, how far is it? Now, if that regulation had said, thou shalt keep them 15 feet away,
right,
and we're 20 feet away, you got it, okay?
Go ahead, Marshall.
Sorry,
I just want to say, I think it does kind of say, you know, because it doesn't say just separate, it says separated if a fire hazard could be created. I think the idea is to keep them separated such that it's not a fire hazard. And it, I mean, I your point is well taken, Chair. I wonder if what you're trying to answer is a different case, because, you know, in this case, like Commissioner Jordan said, like, there was a fire, it clearly was not separated such that a fire hazard couldn't be created. So it seems to me that in this case, it is, you know, it is a violation. And I get your point that, you know, well, you want to have more of a broader rule to apply to the next case. But the problem I see is that it's hard to apply a broad rule because you're not going to run into these conditions again of this kind of molten slag and, you know, rubber in a pipe in this way. So I think, you know, we just have to approach these cases with the facts we're presented. But in this case, it seems that because, you know, it did catch fire, and it was a serious fire, I don't see how it couldn't be a violation under these standards.
That's precisely what I'm saying, though. You said under these conditions, would they happen again? Okay, and that's why. There's a lot of different conditions here. In other words, would this happen? But I go back to just what we said. Like, for example, if it keeps separated, that's where I keep coming back to. If we were 6 miles away, is there a fire hydrant? Is there a fire hazard? Okay?
as a fire occurred?
That's my point. Well, that's my point. If
well,
a fire,
I mean, I think we have to look at two different scenarios.
You do.
Right?
I'm 6 miles away. There's a fire at the end of the pipe. How do I know that this is what caused that fire at the end of the pipe? I don't know what's happening in that pipe. In other words, you still have to make a judgment. Is would slag have gotten down? Is the slag the cause of it? So that's what I'm saying is I don't think we got enough to say.
But has anyone made that argument that the slag didn't cause the fire here? That's what I'm wondering. I mean, I get your scenario, but in this case, it's clear the slag caused the fire, right? And, I mean, do you think it was separated?
Well, see, I don't see the per se approach here. That's what I'm. Well, that's my problem is the per se approach with this thing.
I would agree. So on that point, because that's what I wanted to sort of get at, is this per se. You know, I don't think it's necessary to get to that. I'm not saying now that there is like a per se or not a per se. What I'm saying is that, as like what Moshe was saying, it has to be separated so there is not a fire. In this case, there was a fire, therefore it could not have been separated so that there wasn't a fire. If we had gotten a situation, this exact same case, let's take the exact facts of this case, except the inspector shows up on his own and he sees this drain, and for whatever reason, he knows there's rubber down in there, and he says, hey, there's rubber in that drain, why don't you cover that drain pipe? And they say, no, it's 15 feet apart, and we believe that means it's separated, and he cites them. Then we'd have that discussion. There wasn't a fire there. We have to decide and maybe it is a reasonable person. I don't know, but we don't have those facts in this particular case. We have an actual fire that was caused because as a matter of fact, it was not separated enough to prevent a fire in this case. So I'm not saying we say any per se thing. I understand that point. I hadn't thought of that point about separation, but as I'm thinking about it now, I mean, I think if that case arises where we have a violation of this standard with no fire and they're claiming, yes, we separated it enough, that's an interesting question, but I don't know that that's the question that we have.
Well, that's
here.
What I'm trying to prevent is the next one, too. In other words, on this one here, that's the reason why I say kick it back. He could develop enough facts here that could do exactly what we're talking about, enough facts to say, and if I use my reasonably prudent person test, that a reasonably prudent minor under these conditions should have seen that this is going to start that. But that's where I'm coming
well,
from.
Well, see, I wouldn't... Aren't we dealing with a question of law?
Yeah,
that
I think
we
so.
Have to decide? Well, then why would we kick it back?
No, the law part, no. It is facts intensive. You're right, it's fact intensive.
I don't see fact... I mean, to me, maybe I don't have a problem with the per se approach. It is per se. I mean, that's... Well, when you described it, I was going to say, okay, that's per se. You know, the roof falls, you didn't adequately support the roof. If there was a fire, you didn't keep them separate enough.
I mean, I do think if there is a fire, then necessarily...
It wasn't separated enough to avoid the fire.
Right, because there was a fire.
There was a fire. Right. It's implicit in the rule, even though it doesn't say... What was it you said it didn't say? It didn't say... I mean, it doesn't say how much the...
It didn't give the distance. Right.
Okay, you know, factors come into play when you're looking at a situation, various points of law that, you know, I have to take into account. One is there has to be due process in the sense that an operator has to know, what am I supposed to do?
Right.
And I think that's kind of what you're getting
at. Exactly,
it's like you're trying
right.
to, and, you know, they have argued that they need there has to be adequate notice informed by the reg or whatever, the law, that they're on notice of what the obligation is.
Mm-hmm.
And we've looked at that, you know, and the commission has said that if the reg is too vague or the standard vague, you know, we fall back then on, well, you know, what would a reasonable person do? Now, to me, somebody reading the reg about keep the combustible material separated from the ignition source so that a fire hazard isn't created knows what they have to do in the sense that they have to take it far enough to prevent a fire. And
but what is
that? And
what?
It's going to vary. And then
it's
going to
vary.
The resort,
that's what I'm saying,
Mary.
It's
going
to vary. So,
and then you would go to a reasonable person.
That's what I'm saying.
But I think when the fire has occurred,
Yes.
It's not it's not far enough apart.
I understand, but what's the regulation says? It's a distance thing, isn't it?
Well, yeah, but it is important to know.
It's not right, and there's multiple ways to separate.
There is multiple ways to separate.
Yeah, so, right? I mean, you're focusing on distance. They could have used the fire blankets, for instance.
But there is, how would I know to do that? That's my point.
Well, here's the point, too, about the mm-hmm. particular facts in this situation mm-hmm. is that they didn't even know that there was a fire hazard. And I do think that Yates has a beef with the production operator here. That's beyond our
I don't know where you're going.
They didn't know. It wasn't like they said, "Okay, there's a fire hazard here. Uh-huh. We're going to move 15 feet away." Uh-huh. That was happenstance. What if the thing that they were welding was uh-huh. 2 inches away?
Okay.
There's no way you would say 2 inches away from the rubber. They didn't know the rubber was there, and they legitimately didn't know. Would you say that's separated enough? Like, I mean, we're getting into these hypotheticals. All we have are the facts that we have. Like, in that case, we say, okay, well, we have to send it back to the judge to see if 2 inches was far enough, because they didn't actually know in this case. It just was a happenstance that occurred. Did something pop up? Okay, sorry. I don't, like, my point is, like, why are we getting into hypotheticals about what could have happened if there hadn't been a fire? Like, what we have here is a fire, and as a result, we know that it wasn't far enough away in this particular case to prevent a fire. Does that make sense? Like, I mean, they weren't separating it here. It just happened to be separated.
Well, that's what I'm saying, though. I understand where you're coming from. We're probably at, like I said, I'm be the lone wolf here, but I really, maybe we have to agree to disagree.
Yeah. Right?
Because I really see this situation, because I don't want to go here all day long, but I think everybody's pretty well said their piece.
I would say, if we had a different, like, if in the future we have a different case where, you know, like we said, the inspector shows up and cites them, and there is a question of, you know, before anything happened, I might be in agreement with you, Marco, in terms of like what test to apply here, but I just think when it happens, I think it has to be sort of per se.
If we come up with a per se rule right now, then what if I got a situation where I got a 6-foot-mile long pipe? There's a fire at the end of it. Okay? Well, per se, boom, you get stuck. That's what I'm trying to prevent here.
If we know that the heat source caused the combustible material. So, there has to be, you know, if it's just an unrelated fire 6 miles
away.
That's
my point. That's what I'm afraid of, is if we have to watch what we're doing here, is if we come out with like a per se situation, all right, and we say that's what it is, you know, fire, yeah, there it was. It had to be it. I think it's very dangerous, because I think it has to be case by case. And we have to use this reasonably prudent person test to see that. Now, if the judge gets it, now I understand. If the judge gets it, and we have no more facts than what we have, all right, it could very well come out to say that even under that applied test, they should have known this. In other words, did you violate this separation standard? All right, because that's really what all the regulation says, is separation. And it says hazard, all right. But what is that separation? That's my whole point. They didn't give us any, and I think it best by choice is how would you come up with that? You know, depending upon depending upon your heat source and your combustible source, how would you really come up with a distance when you don't know the two? And that's my whole point. They wouldn't have done that in the regulation, and they left it up to the judgment. And that's what I'm saying here. We have to have a judgment element in here. If we just say per se, boom, fire, that's it.
But one thing I think you're missing in when you keep saying fire is there's no question here that the welding caused the fire in the rubber, right? I mean, no one's challenging that. And the examples you keep giving, it sounds like you're saying fire, but no one knows how it happened.
That's right.
That's a different scenario. But here, no one is challenging that welding caused the rubber to catch fire. The rubber didn't catch fire from something else. It's from that, so it's I think significantly different than the sort of hypotheticals you're raising, where an unrelated fire occurs. Because if there was an issue here where the rubber caught fire and had nothing, and the facts showed nothing to do with the welding, then I don't think we'd be sitting here.
Here's another thing in my test too. Nobody knew this thing was rubber lined, right? is that, would a reasonably prudent minor know that? The judge could take a lot of information. These people could say, well, yeah, you know, every time we put these discharge pipes in for slurry, we're always rubber lining. They ought to know that. Different ball game. That's why I'm saying I just don't like that per se approach. I get it. A fire started. I'm afraid we're going down a real path here if we say that and then apply it to cases down the road.
I don't think we're breaking new ground, to be honest. I think so. historically the law. Like, you know,
what's that now?
The strict life, you know, when something happens, you have a roof fall, okay. You have the fire, it's like, well, you had to
support. What's the regulation say?
Regulation says adequate
separate.
Support. Oh, this regulation.
No, yeah, don't talk about it. I'll give you that on roof support. All right, roofs on the ground, I give you that,
okay.
All right? But now this thing is talking about distance, period, right?
No, separation.
What? Separation.
Separation.
I'm sorry, separation.
There are different ways to separate.
That's right. I agree.
Separate.
Did
separate.
They separate? Yeah.
Yeah, well, okay.
Enough that it wouldn't be combustible, you know, that a fire couldn't be created.
The purpose, all right, the roof control standard says adequate support to prevent roof falls.
Right.
I think you're saying this should have said more explicitly or something. Keep these two ingredients apart to avoid a fire. I mean, to me, it's sort of like inherent. The obvious reason for the separation
is
you don't want a fire.
You don't want a fire.
But
right.
I feel like you're relying on the lack of thing. It just says separation, and I don't know what I'm supposed to do. You know, I don't know how I'm going to separate and everything. And it's like, well, you have to separate it so they don't come together to have a fire hazard.
And that's a reasonably prudent person decision. That's what I'm saying. How do you do that?
See, I resort to the reasonably prudent person standard, just as you described, and I think the commission does, when we have a generally worded reg.
Which I think this is.
Right.
Okay.
Well, yeah, okay, because then as I was saying earlier, and the only way the per se comes in is that it's just, I don't know, strange, bizarre, you know, when you actually have a roof that falls, which you concede I give it to you, when you have a fire that actually occurs because two items came together, well, the roof was not adequately supported and the ingredients that are supposed to be separated were not separated enough. Obviously, it's just kind of, It is, I know you're uncomfortable with like a per se approach that could open up a door, you know, and
yeah.
I think it's been used in the act and I don't think it's opened up a door, and I think it's really in narrow circumstances where it gets reciprociloquita. It's hard to stand there looking at a fire or smoke billowing and say, we don't know if there was adequate separation of the combustible material. And the,
What
I'm saying? It's like,
What are they going to do in the future here? Okay? What are they going to do in the future?
You mean when they're trying to figure out how much to separate it?
Yes.
They go to the reasonable, prudent person standard.
That's my point.
And we're in agreement. I mean, but if you try the reasonable, prudent person, and if you still have a fire, well, then it wasn't,
that's,
you know,
all
it's
I'm
a violation. But
is use that test, let the judge look at it. That's all I'm saying. Is I think he used the wrong approach. I really do. If he had used that approach and he would have looked at these facts, my reading of the facts, I don't think there's enough there in the facts to say actually there would have been a hazard, okay? I don't think there's enough there for him to have gone through that.
Can I ask you, what facts do you think the judge could further find in this case under a reasonably prudent person standard that would make this not a violation?
All right, you say, what's a violation and has to result? Let's go down the hazard approach now, okay? All right, first of all, what's the regulation say? Regulation says you got to separate them, all right? That's really what we're looking at, all right? Separate for what? To prevent
so
this hazard.
Occur.
Is there a hazard? Now, I'm going down the Mathis approach now as far as how you would actually come up to the S&S and how you would analyze this thing. When you look at all this stuff now, in other words, what did they have to start with? And that's all these different things. That's what I guess what I'm saying too, Moshe, is I don't know what I don't know. You know?
No, I know, but I mean, if we're going down hypotheticals
right.
you've created.
Right.
In this case, what facts could be found where it wouldn't be a violation. We're not talking SS, just
what's
it wouldn't
the
be a
hazard?
Violation.
All right, this point is, what is the
fire,
hazard?
Fire.
Okay, what's the hazard? All right.
Minors exposure to fire.
Okay.
Well, yeah. I'm talking about the fact of the violation, not SNS.
Right. That's what I'm saying.
Fire, it says,
right.
Separate such that, you know, fire
right.
doesn't occur.
Right.
What in this case could be, what facts could be found that would make it not a violation?
Because the regulation is dependent upon this distance. That's my whole point. It doesn't, when you really look at that regulation, it talks about the distance. In other words,
it talks about separation.
It talks about separation. I'm sorry, separation.
But for fire blankets, for instance, they had them, they could have used them.
But that's my point. And I don't want to beat this too much, but my point is, we're focusing on the wrong thing here. That regulation said the separation between the two. That's, in other words, how do you violate this regulation, okay? It's you violate the separation part of it, right? Now, how am I going to violate that if I don't know what all the parameters are? Did I actually violate it, all right?
But Moshe's question, what facts could the judge, it's hard to imagine the judge
is there a hazard?
Coming up with facts that says there was not a violation because you had adequate separation to avoid a fire hazard.
A fire hazard, that's my point. Okay.
How could the judge reach that conclusion
on
this record when there was a fire?
That is my whole point.
Wait, no.
Yes.
What is your
point? My whole point is this.
Is there any way for the judge to find no violation?
I think there could be.
When there's a fire?
No, we're talking about different now.
We're talking about this case.
We're talking about this case.
You're going to remand this case to the judge.
We're talking about this case, all right? Was there a fire? Yes. But what's the regulation? Regulation says, did they violate this distance? All right? Yes, there was a fire, all right? Did they violate that distance? How do I know if they violated the distance if they actually didn't have the parameters there, if they don't know what it is to do?
It is important to note, though, too, that if you're going to take a reasonable person standard or something on this, remember that they didn't know that the hazard, like the 15 feet is just a coincidence. It could have been 2 inches. They didn't know.
Right.
They weren't separating it.
Right.
It just happened to be separated by 15 feet. So, if you're going to say,
they
were aware of the hazard, they weren't aware of any hazard. They didn't take it into account.
Point.
Yeah, but I mean, the strict liability of the Mine Act, they needed to be,
right.
you know. But I guess I think we're going in circles
we
now.
Are.
I don't.
We are. Yeah, I don't want to beat it to death here, but I guess what it looks like is I guess you guys are in pretty much in agreement, and now I'll do a dissent, but I think that's probably where we're coming out from here, and then we'll take a look at what we got. Right?
And I think that from my point of view, Murray's memo looks like a great place to start on a. I think we're all kind of. The three of us are sort of repeating what you had in your memo, so it's a good place to start.
Yeah.
Good enough said?
Well, we used up an hour talking it.
Sorry.
Saying it. I don't know. I don't think we persuaded it, but that was interesting discussion.
All right. Well, if that's anybody else, got anything else? And I'm sure Rory's going to be back and forth with all of us anyway, right?
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, if that's the case, then let's close the record and go off the record.